This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. In our second half hour, I'll be talking with author, blogger, John Michael Greer. He thinks we can walk back technology to safer options that can live past the crash. But first, we explore the wonders of how the climate really works, why the ozone hole and climate change work at cross purposes, Antarctica and fires in the Southern Hemisphere. It's science, the way I like it, with Dr. Andres Holtz.
Radio EcoShock.
Wildfires are big news in North America, Europe, and Siberia. But what about in the Southern Hemisphere? In January 2017, during the Southern summer, Chile experienced the largest wildfire in its history. A new study recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences says wildfires in Southern South America have increased, and they will become more prevalent as global warming advances. But it's a complicated picture influenced by human behavior, the ozone hole, changing winds from Antarctica, and something called teleconnection. To sort it out, we've reached the lead author, Andres Holtz, from Portland State University. Holtz has a PhD in geography from the University of Colorado, but also a degree in forestry engineering from the Universidad de Chile in Santiago. His specialties include wildfires in southern South America, as well as in Tasmania and New Zealand. Andres, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You study wildfires, and as we speak, you are in a heavy smoke event in Portland, and it's pretty bad around here, too. What is happening in the Portland area?
Oh, we have basically a bit of the perfect storm combinations of factors between a very dry and warm summer that has dried all the fuels, and then apparently ignition, still to figure out exactly the details, but an ignition in a forest that is ready to burn. And here we go. I can barely see the silhouette of the mountains as we speak.
You know, as I look at the world fire scene, my question sounds simple. Have there been more forest fires in southern South America, and is it due to climate change? But reading your paper, it's a very complex mix of factors. First of all, how did you define southern South America?
That's a great question for a geographer. That's a constructed concept. Much like Patagonia or the Pacific Northwest, if you ask 20 people in a room, everybody with a pen and a map, they're going to draw a slightly different region. And so it's a mentally constructed place. We generally speak about the Southern Cone or Southern South America, which includes Argentina, perhaps even bits of Uruguay and Southern Brazil and Chile.
To understand your work, we need to grasp a climate pattern called the Southern Annular Mode, or SAM. It's also known as the Antarctic Oscillation. Please describe that for us.
Sure thing. As you well pointed out, SAM, or the Antarctic Oscillation, it's basically much like a ring of various pressures, of usually high or low pressures, and this ring expands and contracts around Antarctica. There's also a northern annular mode, or the Arctic Oscillation, that is less known and less famous in the northern hemisphere because it's not as prevalent, because it's not as strong, and that's due to basically the fact that the northern hemisphere is a landmass continent, whereas the southern hemisphere is an ocean-dominated continent. And at the southern pole, you have this massive Antarctic continent surrounded by water, and so the actual ring is almost perfect, that when it expands, creates some or drives some particular weather pattern in the mid to high latitude in the southern hemisphere, and similarly in the Antarctic continent as well. And so listeners might be familiar with El Niño or La Niña, which is basically a combination of temperatures in the ocean that drives pressures in the atmosphere that then in turn drive weather patterns. This is more or less the same, with the difference, and the big difference, that it has is mostly and primarily an atmospheric pressure-driven oscillation. It has no ocean temperature component.
So what do pressure systems of Antarctica have to do with forest fires in South Chile and Argentina?
That's a great question. Basically, when this ring expands, and imagine that the boundary of the ring has high pressure centers, what it basically does, much like in the Pacific Northwest, where the westerlies are the one coming from the ocean that bring all the precipitation to this coastal area, this ring, when actually expands with high pressure, blocks these westerlies. And so the westerlies that are carrying the precipitation go towards the poles, in this case, towards the south. And so we have extended and unusually long fire seasons or drought seasons because of that effect of the ring. Then in combination with more ignitions, primarily due to people, humans, living in the area, colonizing the area, traveling in the area, and also an increase in lightning that has been clearly driven by warmer waters, we have, again, this perfect storm of perfect combinations where we see more and more fires.
Now, I have heard of this described to me as a tightening of the winds around Antarctica by another scientist, and he said that affected the rainfall and fires in Australia's Tasmania and in New Zealand. Are we talking about the same thing?
We're talking about the same thing. So my work in Tasmania and New Zealand, it's trying to also understand the relative importance of SAM with ENSO and also with the Indian Ocean Dipole, which is another oscillation that different parts of the Southern Hemisphere are exposed to or basically are influenced by. There's still work to do to understand how these actually interact and feed each other or even buff each other. But yes, it definitely affects very similarly precipitation patterns, temperature patterns, and fire patterns in both New Zealand and southeastern Australia, including Tasmania.
Now, I was surprised to learn from your paper that a major cause of this tightening around Antarctica was not global warming, but the ozone hole. How did that work?
Yeah, the ozone hole, it's an interesting one. And initially, this southern annular mode pattern deviation, if I can call it that way, meaning that instead of going positive, which is the expansion and created this sort of ridge that blocks the westerlies and creates drought and fire, then it switches into negative, which creates actually high rainfall in southern South America and then so on and so forth. It turns out initially that the ozone hole was the first driver identified to influence SAM. A couple of years later, it turns out that also global warming affects the SAM. And it turns out actually that each of them affect them in opposite directions. The ozone hole pushes the ring towards the equator, and the global warming pushes the boundary of the ring towards the pole. And in short, the ozone hole way of impacting the SAM is, if we think about what the ozone does, it's basically, it's a layer that is in the stratosphere that basically converts the quality of the insulation into a quality that is less harmful for life on Earth. When it does so, actually, the stratospheres in above warms up. And so if you reduce the amount of ozone, the amount of conversion of this energy is less, and hence the stratosphere, particularly in Antarctica, has been cooling. And this cooling has been the one affecting now the troposphere underneath. And so the ozone hole is, through a vertical dynamics, is affecting the actual temperature conditions in Antarctica in the troposphere. That in turn now actually enhances the way that the vortex works out. And if you think of Antarctica being this massive continent, the center of Antarctica, or the largest half, which is called East Antarctica, been cooling and cooling. It's one of the regions around the globe, actually, that's been cooling, which in turn now West Antarctica, which is smaller, has been warming very rapidly. And so this cooling now, it's basically almost like a hole that has very high pressure, very cold. And so it pulls the vortex towards it and makes it more and more faster with wetter and wetter conditions in actually mid and high latitudes in southern South America.
And one of the strange aspects, though, is that these changes, Antarctica is still quite far away from most of South America across an ocean. So Please tell us about teleconnection. What is that, and how does that affect what we're talking about, the wildfires?
Teleconnections is the idea there is a connection between two phenomena, in this case, meteorological or synoptic scale climate phenomena that are geographically remotely. And so we can run, for instance, correlations between one phenomena and another and have no clue how they're connected, but they seem to be correlated. It took for us ecologists to wait that the climatologists and atmospheric scientists could figure out what the mechanisms were, if there were any, of course, so that we can actually understand and then use it or apply to try to understand what those impacts were. And in short, it's basically propagations of heat waves between tropical latitudes in the case of warming that go polarward, or the opposite, basically high polar latitudes pulling these high or low ridges or rings of this boundary of the SAM that then in turn affects remotely precipitations all the way up to even northern Chile. There have been studies that have linked and this sort of cascade effect of chain effect all the way to the highlands and the mass of glaciers in the Altiplano at 17 or 20 degrees latitudes, how quick the actual glaciers are melting.
I find that amazing. I mean, we're talking about almost swirls of air, if you will, another kind of ocean that we humans are not really equipped to understand. You know, we don't run into this every day. So we're just finding out about teleconnection. I mean, one of the early scientific theories about how it worked turned out to be false. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, well, my understanding of it, and I'm not a climate scientist, is that climate teleconnections really became popular when we understood better the 1982-83 El Niño event. It was the first time that we had satellite data that tracked not only the changes in the geography of the warm and cold waters in the Pacific Basin, but also the effects of those and the effects of those at tropical latitudes, but then also how those were pushing low and high pressure centers to different latitudes, to different longitudes, and how that in turn were actually affecting areas that were quite remote from the actual tropical latitudes. For instance, South Africa is affected by El Niño. It's far away. Same with India and things that are quite remote. But if you follow, much like a train, they are connected one wagon to the next one into this sort of chain of events or phenomena.
Now, humans have restricted the use of ozone-damaging chemicals. If the ozone hole begins to shrink, as we hope, does that mean that wildfires in the southern part of South America could begin to decline?
That's a great question. We were very hopeful of that. First, quick caveat is the ozone hole is recovering in a more erratic pattern than we or most scientists expected. And so we see that it's recovering, but then has something like hiccups and then expands again. And so most projections from a decade ago or so would have put a current ozone hole much smaller than we see today. That's one. And then the second is that now we have global warming affected the SAM as well. And so the SAM, it's, as I pointed out before, so global warming is pushing the SAM in the opposite direction. And so even though the ozone hole fully recovers, the SAM is going to remain in its positive fire-prone state. And so unfortunately, I don't think that's going to be the case, that fires are going to be are going to start declining in the future because of SAM, and let alone because of things like El Niño and even secular trends of warming that are more like steady warming up and up.
Well, let's get to your specialty in the forests themselves. What kind of forests are considered in your study?
This was a meta-analysis. It's a large synthesis of 17 plus 100 fire-scarred trees across from subantarctic latitudes at 54 degrees or so, all the way to 22 in subtropical latitudes in northern Argentina, right at the boundary with Bolivia. And so it encompasses from tiny trees and what it would be almost boreal forest in the northern hemisphere, what we call subantarctic forest, which is a tiny, tiny biome or even ecosystem. Then moving farther north with more polar rainforests, cool first and warm rainforests, then an overlap or a transition zone between temperate and Mediterranean type of forest, which would be basically like Western Oregon right here in terms of the analogy for the Northern Hemisphere. And then moving into more savanna-like type of forest in central Chile and also in northwestern Argentina.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith talking with Dr. Andreas Holtz about new science on why wildfires are increasing in the southern part of South America. So you study trees that were damaged by fires. How far back does that record take you, and what was the general period used for your paper?
The oldest fire scar that we found was in 990 AD, so basically 1,100 years old fire scar. And this was from a Fitzroya cupressoides, also termed the redwood of the southern hemisphere. So very wet rainforest that burned very infrequently and that had fire scars.
But you used from the 1600 ons for most of the basis of your paper, is that right?
That's right. Mostly because we wanted to see what most of the trees were telling us. We started the analysis during a period where our sample size was high, was strong enough.
All right. Now, you say the activities of humans are a further complication. We have colonists burning away forests for agriculture, later the whole technology of fighting forest fires. How did you account for that in your study?
Fortunately for this type of analysis, and unfortunately for the forests themselves, fire suppression in general, it's been a very incipient technological advance in southern South America. And so perhaps only in central Chile, starting in the 50s or so, and then also in some of the Araucaria monkey puzzle tree forest in the 40s in northwestern Patagonia, it's really the first time where we see a very small effort to stop fires. And because of that, that's exactly the time where we actually truncated the analysis.
And we know that wildfire activity is harmful to human health. In fact, I haven't been able to go outside as much as usual this summer due to multiple large fires in British Columbia and in Washington State. But you also suggest the release of carbon from increasing fires could become, quote, a strong feedback to the climate system. Please talk to us about that.
So carbon coming from fires in some particular years can be a significant contribution for the global carbon emission of a given year. And if this becomes more and more recurrent and becomes a norm, we know that higher concentrations of carbon in the atmosphere, like any other greenhouse gas, both delays the amount of heat that actually, or traps more heat, so increases the amount of heat that gets trapped in the atmosphere, and at the same time delays furthermore the release of heat into the outer space. So our greenhouse, we call it greenhouse because it's not a perfect greenhouse that fully keeps the heat, but definitely delays the actual rate of heat dissipation into outer space. And so it makes sense to think that if we have more CO2 coming out of fires, we're going to see more warming. And then in turn, those forests whose fires depend on higher temperatures are expected to see more and more fires along with longer fire seasons.
I talked to a Canadian fire expert who said that, sure, we expect some of that carbon to be recaptured as forests regrow, but if they get extreme fires in a short period of time, then the forests don't regrow and it converts into grasslands or some other type of vegetation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. Some of the ongoing projects and also pending proposals, we hope they turn into projects in the future, are exactly trying to look at that. Trying to understand what the short and mid-term impacts of particularly fires that burn on previous burns, what we call reburns, and what the ecological effect of that is. And in our hunch is that to some extent, this might be a little lens into the future, maybe 50, 100 years from now, where vegetations dry out naturally or not naturally, but directly from climate, not through burning. And that actually basically favors plants and taxa in general that is more drought adapted. Whereas when fires burn and a wet forest or a magic forest and then burns it again and burns it again and becomes a shrubland or even a grassland, well, this might be actually a sort of a travel or a journey to the future to see how this forest might be in 100 years from now. And so understanding what are the main players of those novel ecosystems today can help us to perhaps develop policy around that or even agree on what we would like to see in the landscapes.
Once you assembled your record, Andres, of fires over several centuries, can we say for certain that wildfire activity has increased since the 1900s, say, in southern South America?
We definitely see, I think, both. We see variability in general, up and down, and in some areas we can say yes, we see an increase in fire activity. It's hard to see or to say that these increases are only due to global warming, because as I pointed out before, we need ignitions. And as most coastal rainforests on western sides of continents around the globe, ignitions are rare. And so we have yet to see a pervasive increase of lightning strikes everywhere in the southern, in the wet forests in South America. That said, we definitely see an increase in lightning activity, statistically significant, particularly steadily in the mid-1970s when ENSO and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation both flipped at their sign in 1976-1977, and that created massive changes in the temperature of the water, the amount of pressure cells, the convectivity, which in turn drives ignition patterns and so on and so forth in terms of lightning. And so I guess the answer is depends, and in some places, yes, in some places, no. And to wrap up, then we also analyze the synchrony of fire activity, and that tends to be increasing in its amplitude, both in higher synchrony and in lower synchrony in very recent times. So it seems that in the past, it was less synchrony and less asynchronous, whereas more recently, we see a much more, I don't know, extreme pattern of very synchronous and very asynchronous.
What do you mean by synchrony in fires?
It's basically a simple idea that sites that are remotely locating are experiencing fires at the same time during the same fire season.
Now, who is watching and measuring these wildfires? Is it governments? Are there other institutions? Who's doing it?
Nowadays, fires are definitely being more and more considered, and I'm speaking now from a Chilean perspective, into the national policy, into the national agenda. When I started working for my PhD, for instance, which was the first work I led in fire ecology and fire climate dynamics, I was told that fires were rare. Fires were only caused by the settlers that moved to Patagonia 60, 80 years ago, and the indigenous didn't burn, and so on and so forth. We had no linings, and turns out that I found lots of fire scars that were pre-settlers, so the indigenous had to be lining, had to be igniting. I also found fire scars that I could tell were from lining, so there were also those. And so I feel that, and then as you well pointed out, last year or this past summer season, there were massive fires in central Chile. There were in last year, in 2015, there were big fires in these 1,000-year-old forests, Araucaria forest, and even some bits of Fitzroya, both the monkey puzzle tree and the redwood in southern Chile and northwestern Patagonia in Argentina, that were burned, and people were very pissed off and very angry and very sad about this. And the government definitely struggled in terms of how to deal with this. They did the best that they could. But at the same time, now it's the idea to gather and think about policies for restoration, what restoration should look like, and so on and so forth.
What can our listeners in Australia and New Zealand learn from your newly published paper?
Well, New Zealand is a fascinating place to study fires, and collaborators there have been doing this for several decades. New Zealand is an area that is uber maritime, and so it's very hard for New Zealand to get any lightning whatsoever because it's so thin, and it's obviously extremely wet on the west side and less so in the east side. And New Zealand also, it's a natural, beautiful experiment because a laboratory, because it had no humans until 800 years ago. And so we can look at the non-human fire dynamics, fire climate dynamics, which, again, being so maritime driven, it was very, very slim and very, very few fires, and how then Maori people, Polynesians, change the vegetation through fire in just a few decades, even maybe a century or so. And even though it's been estimated that there were very few people. And so New Zealanders, I would say that they generally perceive fires as something totally foreign, totally alien. And in the last 10 years, I feel that that is also starting to change. And I think it was this past summer that New Zealand also saw some major fires outside of, I don't remember the city that it was, but it was, people were definitely concerned. In fact, I was at a meeting in May, I believe. Yeah, it was in May where I sat down with a couple of New Zealand ecologists, and they were like, yeah, we were concerned. And so it's definitely something that's going to change. And one of the best papers and analysis on the impact points of going back to the farm on drought and fire risk has been shown for New Zealand. And so even though it's so maritime, the only thing that it needs is an ignition at the end of the summer, and that forest or many of those forests can burn again.
I know. I talked to a fire expert in Tasmania, and they had a shocking fire season, as we all know. It was well reported in the world news. But even a forest in the northern part of Tasmania that hadn't burned for many, many centuries caught fire. It was a national park, I believe it was. It was very frightening for the people there.
Yeah, I have a hunch who you talked to, who is probably my collaborator in Tasmania, that I worked there as a postdoc fellow. And we were exactly working there in the central northern area where this 1,000-year-old forest, or I don't know, many hundreds of year-old trees in this subalpine, almost tree-lined plateau, central plateau, it's called. It was very, very severely burned 3 years ago or so.
Yes.
3 years ago. And it was very scary. We are actually currently working on a landscape scale analysis of the fire refuges in Tasmania to try to see whether some of these very millennial scale longleaf conifers, very iconic species, have any chance, or what their potential conditions will be in the future when we unfortunately think that they're going to see more and more fires.
Well, as we wrap up here, Andres, what further research needs to be done now when it comes to southern South America?
At this point, I feel that we have understood fairly well how climatic conditions are driving fires, but we have a lot to learn about how now ecosystems are responding to this apparent surge of wildfire. And so understanding how, for instance, invasive species affect the recovery of native forests, how native but also exotic mammals, for instance, are affecting the densities of seeds that could potentially be coming to a forest, or if they are being browsed or predated, maybe they're going to be coming to that shrubland, grassland that we discussed before with many invasives. What is going to be the impact of climate change on their recovery? Those are really open questions that we know very little, if anything.
Well, we've never been through a climate change as extreme as it appears we're heading into now, so it's difficult to tell. We have been speaking with Dr. Andres Holz from Portland State University. He's the lead author of the new paper titled Southern Annular Mode Drives Multicentury Wildfire Activity in Southern South America, that was published at the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, or PNAS, in August 2017. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Andres, it's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure for me as well.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Until the Industrial Revolution and the age of fossil power, humans did live sustainably because there was no other choice. Now this civilization seems headed off a series of cliffs, whether it's climate change, wiping out nature, or nuclear demise. Is there another choice, really? Maybe, says author John Michael Greer, we should steer toward the past. Greer is the author of at least 30 books. He deals with alternative lifestyles, ways of thinking, science fiction, a lot of things. His former blog, The Archdruid Report, has a huge following with a lively discussion area. Greer credits his online community as part inspiration for his new book, The Retro Future, Looking into the Past to Reinvent the Future. John Michael Greer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on again.
Okay, so we can't even think of thoughts we need to discuss without first clearing a few mental landmines that block the way. And the first is often talked about, but few people get past it. Talk to us about the illusion, once again, of never-ending progress.
Oh, yeah. The thing is, you have to understand that progress is the established religion of the modern times. People believe in progress the way medieval peasants believed in the wonder-working bones of St. Ethelfrith. You know, progress is supposed to be omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent. Of course, it's nothing of the kind. But so many people have so much of the hope stuck in this notion that there's this automatic slant to history that means that, well, maybe our lives suck, but in our grandchildren's or our great-grandchildren's time, they will live under they'll live in the perfect progressive utopia. It's nonsense, but like so many kinds of nonsense, people are very deeply emotionally attached to it. And so getting past that religious faith in progress, getting to the point where we realize that progress just means going further in the same direction you're already going, and that progress actually suffers from the same law of diminishing returns as everything else. The first breakthroughs are marvelous. The second breakthroughs are cool. The third ones are pretty good. The fourth, you know, by the time you're getting, you know, 200, 300, 400 years down the road, they're starting to lurch and it's starting to get pretty ugly. There is no rule that we have to keep on going in the same direction. There is no law of nature that requires us to keep on accepting worse and worse products, worse and worse lifestyles, worse and worse everything, just because, you know, some bozo at an ad agency labels it the latest heroic step in progress in man's march from the caves to the stars. It's religion.
But hang on, I'm pretty sure that an app will appear on my iPhone that will solve the energy problem.
I admire your faith. And in fact, that's just it. There have been a few things in recent years where there has been actual technological progress, and computer technology, and generally that the whole range of information technology, has actually had some significant gains over the last few decades. Look at all the things that haven't. Your car is basically a piece of 1880s technology gussied up with a few microchips. Okay? Airplanes have not advanced significantly since the end of the Second World War. Most of the technology that actually fills our lives today, our grandparents used the same technologies or you know, were around when they arrived. And so it becomes this desperate clinging to faith in a faltering belief system, very much like the communism that I mocked there earlier. You know, people in the communist countries back in the day all, you know, were taught to believe that, you know, our grandchildren will live under communism, you know, the withering away of the state, the coming of the workers' utopia. And all the time, things actually got worse and worse and worse. We're in exactly the same situation now.
I worry the second illusion that you deal with in your second chapter is also, in a way, related to a problem with your book, though, and that is that humans can decide what's going to happen with our future. Can we really?
Well, to a certain extent, we can decide what will happen with our own personal futures, okay? You can actually choose what to... The main point that I made in that chapter is that you actually have a choice as to which technologies to use. You don't have to use whatever some ad agency wants to shove on you, what some marketer wants you to use. We have a range of choice. That doesn't mean we have absolute choice. Among other things, the Star Trek future, I don't care how much you want that, you're not going to get it. It's become painfully clear over the last 30, 40 years. That whole thing, the whole expansion across the galaxy, blah, 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 it's a pipe dream. And whatever they're putting in the pipes, you can have that if you want. But at any rate, we have some flexibility. We have some freedom. We can make choices. We can say, sure, I'll buy into the latest cheap, shoddy, ecologically devastating, loaded with nasty side effects technology, whatever it is. Or I could say, no, you know, I think I'm going to keep what I have, or worse still, you know, the thing that I was using 10 years ago actually did a better job for less cost and had fewer side effects and problems. I think I'm going to go back to that.
Well, just like you, I'm tired of the green prophets who promise we can use renewable energy like solar or wind and never have to give up anything in our current lifestyles. We'll drive around in electric cars and feel good about it, or maybe everything will be powered by biofuels. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. That's been going on since I was in high school. Biofuels, yes, we're going to use ethanol. Well, no, that doesn't work. Algal, that doesn't work. Let's try the next. They've gone through a whole cascade of things. The problem is the Earth doesn't absorb enough concentrated energy from the sun. Lots of diffuse energy, okay? Sunlight is not that hot. And so it doesn't. We don't have enough concentrated energy to run our kind of extremely hyper, super, duper energy-intensive, wasteful society. We can have a perfectly sensible, perfectly comfortable, perfectly viable, perfectly humane society on a lot less energy than we have now, but we're going to have to get rid of a whole range of energy-wasting habits.
Yeah, I'm going for bicycles myself. I think that's the way to go. I've got a cargo bike, and that means I can pick up my groceries, I can carry around a kid or anything I want with it. Don't need the car.
Exactly. A bicycle is a really good way. The technology that I tend to use to get around is called shoe leather. And that's, you know, it works for me very well. The neighborhood where I live right now is, you know, it's convenient. I can get to places and so on. Of course, getting to places may involve walking a mile, but hey, that's my health care plan, okay?
Yeah. You know, your new book, it's just loaded with powerful phrases like this one. A great many people these days seem to have lost the ability to grasp that the other side can learn. And you were talking first about foreign policy, and I kind of jumped ahead of you and thought, well, yeah, but what about parasites and bacteria and all that? What if an intelligent nature decides we're just an interesting experiment, but we're too dangerous to allow to continue?
Or, you know, whether nature chooses that, whether, you know, some virus or bacteria just says, ooh, look at the dinner menu. The thing is, we have this fantasy, and this is like the religion of progress. It's like this fantasy of perpetual progress, okay? The notion that human beings are the only things that can actually change anything. If anything happens in the world, it must be some human being that's doing it. Nature can't do anything by itself. Nothing else can do anything by itself. We are history's actors. That was Karl Rove's delusional line back a few presidencies. And, of course, we know how well that worked for him. The fact is, when we start dumping pesticides on our fields, we just set up the situation so that any plant that can evolve around those pesticides has its open season. You know, any weed, any bug, any plant fungus, you know, it's field day for evolution in this situation. We've lost track of the fact that if we act, other things can react, and they may not react the way we want them to. Half of what's going wrong in our society today is precisely this stupid notion that we can just do whatever we want and nothing will happen. Nature will just sit there. Sorry.
I'm afraid that you've poked away at one of my sacred cows. You say that science may change away from institutional academia, but I have to say that many of the brilliant scientists I've interviewed on Radio EcoShock come from that institutional or modeling environment. I don't think that's done yet.
Well, it may not be done in the sense of there are still things that institutional science can discover. The problem is institutional science going to retain the funding? Is it going to retain the social prestige? Is it going to retain the institutional support that enables it to do those kind of things? Now, at this point, when, you know, every week some scientist comes on and says, you remember all that stuff that we told you last week about cholesterol or whatever it is? Well, it was all wrong.
That happens over and over again.
It happens, and every time that happens, the people outside the scientific community are looking up with their beady eyes and saying, okay, so why should we believe you this time? And the thing is, they're right to ask that question. Because so much of science these days is corrupt. So much of it is bought and paid for by corporate interests. So much of it is bought and paid for by political interests. What was once one of the grandest achievements of the human mind has become just another marketing department for various commercial interests and political ideologies. And people know that. People are aware of it. And that's why when some bozo in a white lab coat gets up in front of you and says, okay, everything you knew was wrong, here's what you should believe, a growing number of people just look at that and say, okay, why should we trust you? Give me a reason. And the guys in the white lab coats do not handle that well.
So, John Michael Greer, is it true you don't have a television, and how can you live like that?
Well, it is in fact quite true that I don't have a television. I have not had a television in my adult life. And as for how I can live with that, well, you know, here's a secret. Before the 1950s, everybody on the planet lived without a television. You know, they actually seem to have gotten along just fine. Not only that, they got a lot more done than most people get nowadays when they spend 4 to 6 hours a day, you know, with drool puddling on their laps as they sit there watching the Idiot Bugs. I constantly get people asking me, how do you find the time to write all these books and do this and do that and do the other things? And my answer is very simple. I don't have a television. I have a life instead.
What a concept. I'm sort of worrying that some of the retro movements may be drawing on that same demon of nostalgia that powered Donald Trump into the presidency, saying, go backwards in time and make America great again. Maybe nostalgia is one of the drugs that is poisoning our brains. How would you avoid that?
Well, the first thing, we could get have a long talk about a lot of what drove the whole Donald Trump phenomenon. Many of our listeners may know, I actually predicted his election in January of 2016, most of a year before it happened. And it's not just nostalgia. There were a lot of failures on the part of the existing political system that basically opened the door to what's happened. But the thing is, nostalgia for the sake of nostalgia is a bad idea. What we need is the idea that we can look at the past and the present, all the available options, and say, okay, which one of these actually serves our purpose? So it's not a matter of wholesalely embracing any particular part of the past, much less a sort of imaginary past of the kind that so many people put their minds to these days. It's a matter of just taking the past as a smorgasbord, taking the past and the present, and say, okay, I want one of these, I want two of those, I'm going to take a scoop of this, and mixing them together and see what works. You're not supposed to do that, by the way. That's a total taboo in today's society. You're supposed to just take whatever the nice man on the television wants you to buy. That's not a sane option these days. That's not a survivable option these days. So, you know, come check out the smorgasbord. Come pick up some things and try this and try that and see what works for you personally instead of what works for some Wall Street executive who's trying to shove this stuff down your throat.
I'm aware of several attempts in history to go back to a golden age. The Chaldeans tried to go back to the script and social system of Babylonia, and then all through European history there have been a series of reclamations of the new Roman Empire, but it was really always something new.
And exactly. And in fact, if we do a retro future, if in fact people, realizing that a lot of what we have, what the latest offerings of products are junk, go back to older technologies and older things, it's not going to be going back to some kind of past situation. They're going to do something new with it. An example that I really like these days, typewriters are coming back in. They're being used by artists and poets as performance piece instruments. And there are all kinds of new things being done, things that nobody would have ever thought to do with a typewriter back in the day when everyone typed with one. So, you see, going back becomes a springboard to go forward in a different direction. Remember, progress just means going forward the same way you're going. If you're going off a cliff, that's not a good idea. Go 90 degrees to one side. Go any place. The world is much more three-dimensional. It's not just this straight line going, again, the way some corporate jerk wants you to go.
What do you think of the many predictions that artificial intelligence will replace most of the current workforce, creating a new class of poverty?
They've been saying that since before I was born. It was always going to happen 10 years from now. Seriously, in 1960, they were saying by 1970, 85% of all jobs in America will be replaced by robots. The secret, of course, is that as our economy winds down, as the vast, you know, attempting to prop up an economy that was once propped up by cheap fossil fuels on an endless supply of debt, as that breaks down, a lot of jobs are going away. It's not a matter of people being replaced by robots. It's a matter of an economy coming unglued and people having to step down toward other ways of making a living that don't necessarily feed the pockets of the rich. It's very, very convenient for people who don't want to look at the end of progress to say, oh, no, all this unemployment, it's because of robots, it's because of AI. We have to focus on this idea of progress ever into the future. It's falling dead at our feet. Right now, the great God, progress, you know, remember Nietzsche said God is dead. We need a new Nietzsche to say progress is dead, okay? No, there's no heartbeat. There's no pulse. It's lying there, twitching in front of us. Let's do something else.
I'm Alex Smith with my guest, author and historian of ideas, John Michael Greer. This is Radio EcoShock. You've covered in a previous work another way out, which is Collapse Now and Avoid the Rush. Which book do you recommend for that?
That one would probably be The Ecotechnic Future.
Okay. And let's say we need to go back to a time when technology was sustainable, as you suggest. How far back might that be?
It's almost impossible to say because we're not going back to a single time. Again, the smorgasbord approach is what we have to have in mind. We can pick one thing here and one thing there, something from 1950 and something from 1920 and something from 1850 and something from the Bronze Age, if that works. It's not a matter of going back to a specific time because history is not a straight line. It's a smorgasbord. You can pick what you want, assemble it. There's something that people used to talk about, bricolage, the habit of just picking and choosing and putting stuff together like a mosaic. We need a technological bricolage right now. We need to take that approach toward our technology rather than just thinking that, you know, that just because you use a steam engine, you have to wear a Victorian top hat.
In the early 1980s, my wife and I spent 10 years living without electricity. We didn't have a phone or any services. It was a great time, but it helped us to be young and strong, and I'm not sure that works for seniors or people with health problems. What is your advice for people thinking of unplugging?
The thing to do is look at what you actually need and distinguish that from what you've simply gotten used to. And also, you don't have to do it whole hog. Again, smorgasbord. Pick and choose. Decide, okay, you know, I think I need to have this technology so I can get in touch with my doctor or so I can do this or that or the other. But these other technologies, I don't need them. And in fact, I don't want them. They bore me. So I'm not going to do them. And if people say, well, you have to have that, you can tell them to get stuffed. You don't have to do it whole hog. You don't have to go completely off the grid, unless you want to, in which case, by all means. But pick and choose. Remember, the heresy of technological choice is the thing I'm trying to talk about here. And it is a heresy. Believers in the religion of progress shriek and clutch their pearls or their neckties, take your choice, when you mention it. But yeah, you can choose what technologies you want. Go ahead, pick and choose, chuck the ones that don't meet your needs, and take a hard look at the ones that you think you need and say, okay, do I actually need this? Or am I just fooling myself? Is it just something that's wasting my time, you know, eating my brain, and I could get much more done without it?
Millions of people in North America and Europe are clueless about how dependent they are on the fossil fuel system until a fire, an earthquake, or a flood disconnects them, and then 3 days and riots break out. Talk to us about system dependency, John Michael Greer.
Oh, yeah. Basically, most people in modern industrial society are horribly vulnerable, and they're vulnerable because they depend on these vast, sprawling technosystems. It all seems very convenient, as you say, until something breaks down, and things are breaking down more and more often. As the global economy declines, as we run further and further into the depletion of fossil fuels and non-renewable resources, those breakdowns are going to become more and more frequent. On the one hand, the more things you can do without, the safer you are, the easier it's going to be to take care of yourselves and your loved ones. On the other hand, to the extent that you could do without this stuff, you're going to free up space for people who actually do need it. So it becomes very much a matter of, what do you actually need? And then, are there ways you can get it that don't involve being dependent on some vast, sprawling bureaucratic monstrosity that could be taken out by, you know, a 50-cent fuse blowing 500 miles from you?
So you do have some concrete proposals of technologies that could survive our current civilization. You talk about seven of them, for example. Would you talk about just a couple so we get the idea?
Okay, here's one example. Radio. In every community in the United States, in Europe, in most of the world, in fact, amateur radio used to be a really big thing. Now it's kind of an odd little hobby. But these are people who build, in many cases, they build their own radio equipment. They can, you know, communicate across the planet using a very little electricity and simple gear, the kind of things people were using in the 1950s or the 1920s. And so that's a technology that could survive for the very long term, and it's a technology that's extremely useful right now. Whenever there's a natural disaster, the hurricanes that we've had in Florida and Texas right now, immediately, as soon as that happened, all the ham radio people were getting out there, you know, basically digging themselves out of the rubble, getting an antenna up, firing up their things, and opening and setting up a communications net. That's incredibly important, and that's something that could survive our civilization entirely, because, again, you can make this stuff out of some fairly simple material. Another example, and one that's very dear to my heart, is the printing press. One of the things we know about Dark Ages, about what happens when a civilization crashes, if they've got printing, your recovery is much quicker. It's much less problematic, much less traumatic, because you can mass produce documents. In China, in Japan, they've had several Dark Ages over the last couple of millennia, and they were using woodblock printing. It's a very simple technology. But they could mass produce documents that way. In Europe during the last Dark Age there, they didn't have a printing press until later on, until they figured out how to do printing. And every manuscript, every document had to be copied by hand. That really slowed things up. If people can get into printing now, get into just simple hand-operated printing presses, and pass that technology on, that could go straight through whatever the future has to throw at us, and make it much easier for us to recover in the future. Those are two very simple examples, but they're things that anybody can contribute to.
You know, I had a printing press a few years ago myself, and you have to get used to typesetting the letters backwards, but that's another problem. You know, I love it that in this age of computers and prepackaged thought and TV talk shows, you are calling for, quote, a revival of the skills of thinking. Is it too late?
No. The great thing about the human brain is that you can actually learn. You don't have to wait for some, vast corporation to provide you with an upgrade. You can just, start thinking. Not only that, a lot of the basic skills of this were worked out 2,000, 3,000 years ago. So most of the bugs are out of the programming at this point. So all you have to do is just start asking yourself hard questions like, how do I know that that's true? And if that were true, then what else would be true so I can check it? And, what are some of the basic logical fallacies? This was worked out by the ancient Greeks. What are the kinds of arguments that people go to when they're lying through their teeth? You can identify that, that's an ad hominem argument. I remember that one. You are full of... So it's not that difficult. It's really easy. Well, every human being that has a functional brain has the capacity to make use of this very, very ancient, very effective tool set. And the amount of annoyance that causes to politicians and marketers, that's just lining up. That's fun. That adds to the fun.
Here's the type of thinking and the type of sentence that brings down critics howling on John Michael Greer. You say, if there's such a thing as a natural human society, the basic Dark Age society is probably it. Why would you say that?
Well, when you look at history, every society starts out in about the same place. If you take Dark Age European society and Dark Age Japanese society, the bottom of the Sengoku Jidai of the samurai period, if you take Dark Age Greek society before classical Greece started going and so on, they're all basically running the same thing. They've all got, the heroic mythos. They've got a kind of proto-feudal social structure. You could, Gilgamesh and Beowulf could swap monsters and nobody would notice the difference. As a society develops, it becomes more and more differentiated. It goes its own way. It develops its own unique ways of approaching all the various problems that human societies have to deal with. And so it becomes more and more differentiated. So, while in feudal Greece and feudal England were very similar, by the time you get to the Greek Renaissance and the English Renaissance, it's completely different. And classical Greece and modern England, almost nothing in common. Then the civilization runs itself into the ground. All the usual problems crop up. They burn through their resource base. They destroy their environmental basis. They slam face first into the usual problems and go tumbling back down to another Dark Age society. We don't like to think of history as going in cycles, but it is as predictable as the human life cycle. Okay, we're all born. We grow up, assuming we live to grow up. We hit puberty. We go through the usual convulsions of puberty. We mature. We get old. We die. So do civilizations in a very similar pattern. You can, if you look through history, you'll watch it again and again with the same kind of landmarks on the way. And so getting past the fantasy that says, no, we're different. We're going to live forever. We're going to go zooming off to the stars and nothing will ever change for us again. that's nonsense.
But you, but hold on. You think we're in a cycle of time and of history, though, and so you wouldn't agree with Dr. Guy McPherson when he says that near-term human extinction is facing us due to climate change.
He's been predicting that for years. In 2009, he was saying that by 2012, there would be no longer any cars on the road because we'd be all out of oil. Yeah, you know, I appreciate his sincerity and his honesty, but he really needs to study some history and to get an idea of the extent to which we're simply following a familiar pattern.
Have you seen any signs that the retro future you write about is already trying to be born?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right now, for example, sales of electronic books, e-books, are actually declining steadily, whereas sales of printed books are going up again. One of the big social changes in large parts of the English-speaking world these days is people are ditching their smartphones and going back to old-fashioned flip phones or even, heaven help us, landlines. I'm on a landline right now. I don't use a cell phone, by the way. There's a broad awareness that a lot of the things that were done 50 and 100 years ago simply produce better results than the stuff, the equivalent things you get nowadays. And you've started to get people starting to cash in on that, people starting to look at that and saying, you know, if I produce something using these old techniques, everyone's going to go, oh, that's higher quality. I'm willing to pay a little extra for that. And so we're actually starting to see a movement in a lot of different fields toward a kind of retro culture, a kind of retro technology, by people who simply want something that's good rather than something that's progressive.
We've been talking with the prolific author and blogger John Michael Greer. I just finished his book, and I found it very stimulating. I took a lot of notes, a lot more than we can get into today. His new book is The Retro Future, Looking into the Past to Reinvent the Future. And you can find John Michael's new blog at www.ecosophia.net. And there's links to some of his works in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Is there anything you'd like to add as we wrap up, John Michael Greer?
I'd like to encourage everybody to look at the technology in their lives and say, do I actually want this?
It's been a pleasure having you on Radio EcoShock again.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. I've got two top scientists lined up for next week as we explore extreme climate changes and maybe another way out. I'm Alex Smith, your dedicated nonprofit broadcaster. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.